Word of mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. 4 years after the 2008 presidential election, the name Bill Ayers remains somewhat radioactive. In a new memoir, Ayers recalls the April evening when his name was first invoked as a barometer for patriotism. A group of students was visiting. One turned on the debate between Democratic nominees. Moderator George Stephanopoulos turned to candidate Barack Obama and said,
on this issue, general theme of patriotism in your relationships, a gentleman named William Ayers. He was part of the Weather Underground in the 1970s. They bombed the Pentagon, the Capitol, and other buildings. He's never apologized for that. And in fact, on 9/11, he was quoted in the New York Times saying, "I don't regret setting bombs. I feel we didn't do enough." An early organizing meeting for your state Senate campaign was held at his house, and your campaign has said you're friendly. Can you explain that relationship for the voters and explain to Democrats why it won't be a problem?
Georgia,
Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident is Ayers' record of becoming what he calls a punching bag during that campaign. In the book, Ayers owns up to his activities as a, quote, unrepentant terrorist, and writes about being the target of a multi-million dollar campaign to demonize him. He recalls the hate mails, the death threats, and canceled lectures with spirited prose and a surprising sense of humor. And Bill Ayers joins us now from Chicago. Bill, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. Happy to be here.
Fill out that scene for us in 2008 when you heard your name in that debate.
Well, you know, in some sense, we knew something like that might be coming because as candidate Obama became more and more viable, it seemed inevitable that something that had been percolating in the fever swamps of the right wing would move toward the mainstream. And, of course, George Stephanopoulos was more or less doing Hillary Clinton's bidding in that debate. And raise this question. For me, sitting at home, you know, I'd had my graduate students over, we'd had a potluck, someone turned it on, and a few minutes into it, the clip you just played came over our television. And I have to say, my students absolutely were dumbfounded. Several dropped to the ground, holding their hands over their eyes. One young woman turned to me and said, "Can you believe it? He has the same name as you." And one of the other students said, "That's because it's the same guy. This is Bill, the same guy." And the odd thing about that night, of course, was that suddenly broadcast into the country and the world was this narrative that turns out, I think, to be quite a false narrative. But my students, who kind of knew me quite well minutes before they heard this, now felt like they didn't know me at all. Yeah. And I felt kind of the same way. I felt a little bit out of body myself. But it turned out that this narrative that Hillary Clinton developed, the idea that Obama was a mystery man and that we didn't know anything about him, but he had these shady friends, Jeremiah Wright, the preacher in the south side of Chicago, Rashid Khalidi, and me, and then tried to string this idea that guilt by association would rule the day. The interesting thing is it didn't work for Senator Clinton and it didn't work for McCain Palin.
So Public Enemy, your new memoir, this follows fugitive days covering your time on the lam in the 1970s especially. So this is the true narrative? Is that what you meant to do with this book?
Well, you've highlighted in the opening of this the kind of, the demonization and the craziness of the 2008 campaign, but that's really a relatively small part of the book. I really try to pick up where Fugitive Days left off, and Fugitive Days is the story of a young man, myself, in full-throated opposition to the Vietnam War, and it covers the years 1965 to 75. So this book picks up where that book left off, and it opens in the 2008 campaign, but then it goes back. And the question that it raises is similar to the question raised in the first book, which is, how does one live a life that doesn't make a complete mockery of your values, what you believe? Public Enemy, this book, is much more about teaching and parenting and being a university professor than it is anything much more dramatic than that.
We do learn about your family, your dedication to your community, your relationship with your students, and your wife, Bernadine Dorn. You and Bernadine were on the lam for a decade, and then you decide to turn yourselves in Chicago in 1980. Why did you make that decision?
Well, it was a decision that took longer than it probably should have, but the Vietnam War ended, and that turned out to be the reason for the existence of the organization we were part of. And with the organization gone, it just seemed more sensible after a while. We had two little kids at the time to turn ourselves in, to get straight with the law, to resolve our legal problems. Bernadine had some charges against her. We resolved those. They were charges like resisting arrest, the kind of typical charges from street demonstrations. She was given probation and a fine, and we went back to New York and resumed our work as, in my case, a teacher, in her case, a legal advocate worker on juvenile justice. A couple years later, after the Brinks robbery in Nyack, New York, we ended up adopting a 14-month-old child who was the child of Kathy Boudin and David Gilbert. And at that point, she was called to a grand jury to testify, you know, about that incident. She had nothing to do with it. She knew nothing about it. She thought it was a dreadful action. But she was called before a grand jury, and she felt, as a matter of principle, that she could not talk to the grand jury. And so she was then put in federal lockup, and we were very fortunate. We got her out in, I think, 7 or 8 months.
And just to fill that out, the Brinks robbery was in 1981, after you'd already turned yourselves in. This was involved several Weather Underground members. Two police officers and a Brinks guard were killed in that incident.
Yeah, it was
incident.
People, that's right, and the people who were involved were people who had once been in the Weather Underground and had once been in the Black Liberation Army, the Black Panther. Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing here, Bill, is that Bernadine Dorn, your wife, worked with Michelle Obama. She was the one who was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. Were there times after your name became the black mark on the family when you thought, why me, not her?
Oh, I did. Absolutely. I thought it all along. I mean, she's, if it were me, I'd have chosen the better looking, smarter, more terrific person. But, you know, we thought it was kind of mildly ridiculous and sexist, and no one knows why it happened. Barack Obama and I did sit on a couple of boards together. We did know him as a person around the neighborhood, as he knew us. So, it wasn't what it was kind of projected as. And I guess I'd say one more thing about that, which is that Barack Obama said all during the campaign, I'm a moderate, pragmatic, middle-of-the-road politician. And the right wing looked at him and said, no, he's a secret socialist, secret terrorist, secret Muslim, pals around with these bad people. And the left wing looked at him and said, he's winking in my direction. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't winking. He was exactly who he said he was, a moderate, middle-of-the-road, pragmatic Democrat.
In your book, you mentioned that Obama referred to your past actions as detestable several times throughout that campaign. What about that word to you? Did that sting? I mean, you are indeed unrepentant about the work that you did with the Weather Underground.
Well, what the Weather Underground did definitely crossed lines of legality. It definitely crossed lines, perhaps, of common sense. And so it doesn't strike me as completely bizarre to call those actions detestable. On the other hand, I think there's a reason that the Vietnam War continues to stimulate in us anguish, anger, confusion, disagreement. And that's because we haven't come to terms with the reality of what this country did for 10 years in Vietnam. We haven't spoken truthfully about it. And when we've tried to speak truthfully about it, it has been washed away. So I was arrested opposing the war in Vietnam initially in 1965. I was arrested many times over the next 3 years in nonviolent direct action protest. In 1968, a majority of the people had been won to oppose the war, but we couldn't end it. So one of my brothers, for example, just to take one family, one of my brothers joined the Democratic Party and tried to build a peace wing. One of my brothers ran away to Canada. One went to the communes. And I did what I did. I don't think any of us were brilliant. I don't think any of us were leading. But I don't think any of us were crazy either. The situation was, every week the war dragged on, 6,000 innocent people were killed every week. There was no end in sight. How do you stop it?
We're talking with Bill Ayers, a name that generated a lot of noise during the 2008 election. He's written a memoir called Public Enemy. It's about his life as a parent, an educator, and a husband, and a dissenter since he and his wife came out of hiding in 1980. Well, Bill, your leadership in the Weather Underground earned you the title of domestic terrorist, a status that was invoked by then-vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin at a 2008 rally.
Our opponent is someone who sees America as imperfect enough to pal around with terrorists who targeted their own country.
Sarah Palin there at a rally in 2008. You, of course, were the terrorist that Barack Obama was supposedly palling around with. And you received death threats. Universities tried to cancel your appearances due to a fear for student safety. Were you ever worried that somebody actually might follow through?
I didn't spend any time worrying about it. I mean, it's always a possibility, but I want to refuse to live my life as if, you know, I have to be in a barricaded situation. I think the threats that some universities got when I was scheduled to appear were mostly mythological, mostly, you know, a couple of angry guys with a couple of internet addresses. And I think that's really what it amounted to. I sometimes had pickets outside my talks, and sometimes I've gone out to talk to the people picketing. I do try to engage people, including the Tea Party, in dialogue, because I think that's what we have to do. The reality is I was canceled at I'm still canceled at universities. But the more interesting thing to me is when either a university stands up, or as in the case of the University of Wyoming, when a student group sues the university and says, we don't care about his free speech, it's our free speech that's in danger if we're not allowed to bring controversial or, you know, outside-the-box thinking kind of people to campus. And in the Wyoming case, the students won, and I did go and give a talk, and the talk would have probably involved about 50 students before the big noise that was made about it. And when I finally got out there, 2,500 students came to hear me speak. I think they were a little disappointed when the guy who appeared on the stage was this old professor rather than some fire-breathing terrorist, but there it is. I am who I am.
You have maintained, Bill Ayers, that nobody died because of the Weather Underground's action, but three of your colleagues creating bombs did die.
That's correct. You know, and I write about that both in Fugitive Days and here in Public Enemy. That's a great, great sorrow, a great tragedy, the kind of feeling that'll never wash away. Three of our closest people, including my girlfriend, were killed in 1970 in a townhouse explosion.
That was the approach that you were taking to protest at the time. In the acknowledgments for this book, Public Enemy, you write, I've never been more hopeful for young activists, the world around, for humanity, and for the future. I'm wondering what makes you hopeful now and how those tactics used in the 1960s, was there a failing of those tactics, and have we taken on a new method of protest?
I'm not a tactician, and I think tactics vary. But the most important thing is if you want to bring about real change, progressive change from the bottom up, it has to come from millions and millions of people changing the frame of their outlook on an issue or on several issues. I'm hopeful because young people today are smarter, more aware, more informed and engaged than ever before. And if you look at the kids from the Immigrant Youth Justice League, which was founded at the University of Illinois at Chicago, these are the kids who were undocumented and unafraid. Or you look at Occupy, and you can make fun of Occupy and throw stones at it, but the reality is they too changed the frame. Nobody was talking about the 1% and the 99% before Occupy. So they popularized a metaphor that really underlines income inequality. So I think all of these things are hopeful signs. And I think the crisis that we're facing, whatever we accomplished or failed to accomplish in the 60s, was prelude to the major crises we're facing now, including the life of the planet.
Well, we are, again, living in a divided country. You're a lifelong activist for social justice, an oppositional figure. People still cringe when they hear the name Bill Ayers. It evokes something. Would you like to be known as a divisive figure? Does that work for your brand of activism?
I'm not sure I buy into the assumptions that you're making. You say when my name is invoked, people cringe. Well, not the people I know. So I think, you know, you should be careful about kind of putting your pulse on the public mind. The public mind changes and goes through a lot of things. So I know that nobody wants to believe this today, but when Martin Luther King was assassinated, his positive public opinion rating was below George W. Bush's when he left office. So now we've created an image of Martin Luther King that's a saint. So we all love him now. But loving him when he was actually the angry pilgrim marching for justice and for peace was a little bit harder. So you say we live in a divided country. Yes, it was a divided country during slavery. Mm. It was a divided country during Vietnam. It was a divided country during the Black Freedom Movement. And sure, it's divided, but still we can persevere. Still we can plant our flags, and still we can change the frame and make a difference. And what we do or don't do will make a difference. That's why I think everybody should get busy, get out in the public square, say what they believe in, speak truth to power, and do the best we can.
Bill Ayers, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia. Appreciate it.
Bill is the author of the memoir Fugitive Days, along with several books on education. Until his retirement, he was Distinguished Professor of Education and Senior University Scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His new book is called Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. And you can find links to more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for more Word of Mouth right after the break here on NHPR.